From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are getting a lot of polling data today in the presidential race in some key swing states, and it's looking very good for Hillary Clinton. In Florida, she has a 6-point lead in the latest poll over Donald Trump. In Pennsylvania, she's got an 11-point lead over Trump.
And in Michigan, she's carrying a 9-point lead, Jeremy. And in New Hampshire, a new poll by Here and Now contributor WBUR shows Clinton 15 points ahead of Trump. The poll also shows a big advantage for Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan in her bid to unseat Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte. Senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has our story.
According to the new poll, Clinton leads Trump 47% to 32% in New Hampshire. When Libertarian Gary Johnson and Green Party candidate Jill Stein are omitted, Clinton's 15-point lead swells to 17 points. Among the most important reasons Clinton has moved ahead so dramatically in this important swing state following last week's convention is that Democrats are uniting around her. Here's Steve Cozzella, president of Mass Inc. Polling, which conducted the survey.
So after all the hand-wringing about whether Bernie Sanders supporters would end up supporting Hillary Clinton, she's now getting 86% of the Democratic vote. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has slipped a bit among Republicans. He's now getting a bit less than 2/3 of the Republican vote.
Another big factor, the state's many undeclared voters who favor Clinton over Trump by almost 2-1.
Digging underneath that even further, we see independent women is where the biggest margin of all is among groups that are actually in play. So when you add it all together, Clinton's solidified Democrats, Donald Trump has not done the same among Republicans, and independents are starting to swing towards Hillary Clinton.
Post-convention polls can show big swings before settling down. But the WBUR poll suggests a dramatic development in a state where Donald Trump won the primary last February decisively and where Clinton was trounced by her opponent, Bernie Sanders. The survey found that 48% of likely voters say Clinton is fit to be president. 46% say she is not. But with regard to Trump, less than a third say he's qualified to occupy the White House, and more than 60% say he's not. Selena Katz, an elementary school teacher in Keene, New Hampshire, is among that majority.
It would be, I think, disaster to have him as president.
Is your vote for Hillary Clinton or against Donald Trump, or both?
For Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I feel that she's very experienced. She's very knowledgeable, very rational, and because she works with other people in a cooperative manner, that's what we need as our president.
It appears that in New Hampshire, Clinton got a substantially bigger bump from her convention than Trump did from his. The poll found that about the same number of people watched both conventions, but 56% said that Clinton emerged stronger, compared to 39% who said Trump did. Selena Katz says the conventions reinforced her pro-Clinton view. And she says Trump's post-convention criticism of the Khan family, whose Muslim American son died fighting in Iraq, solidified her negative view of the Republican nominee.
When he talked about what his sacrifices were, they were all business dealings. They had nothing to do with the loss of a child serving in the military to defend the United States.
Less than 30% of New Hampshire voters view Trump favorably. 60% view him unfavorably. In fact, he's a bit more unpopular today than he was 3 months ago when WBUR conducted its last New Hampshire poll. Clinton, on the other hand, has improved somewhat on this score, but she's still far from beloved. 45% have a positive view of her, but the same percentage of voters have a negative view of her. So there are still lots of people in New Hampshire ready to vote against her. Among them, Bill Lauer, a Republican who owns a small farm in Swansea, New Hampshire, who's voting for Trump.
I do not want to see Hillary get in at all costs. Because Hillary Clinton is going to basically continue the agenda of the current administration.
Lauer represents another key finding in the poll. He's among the large majority of New Hampshire voters who think the U.S. and the world are much less safe today than they have been in recent years. So he's drawn to Trump as the law and order candidate. But Lauer says Trump's criticism of the Khan family went too far. And he says sometimes he'd like to tell his candidate to just shut up.
A lot of his advisors have told him that in the past, and he goes on to do and say whatever he wants. he'll get away with it. Ultimately, the people that are standing by Trump and the people that will vote for Trump are voting for, ultimately, they're voting for a change. And that's what's going to get them elected.
The WBUR poll also found the presidential contest is having a big effect on New Hampshire's Senate race between the incumbent Republican, Kelly Ayotte, and the Democrat, Governor Maggie Hassan. According to the poll, Hassan now leads by 10 points in a race that could determine which party will control the Senate.
There's a very close relationship between votes for Kelly Ayotte and Donald Trump.
Again, Steve Cazella of Mass Inc. Polling.
Their support is sort of locked together. And with the direction that Donald Trump seems to be heading in, I think Kelly Ayotte's task is to somehow decouple those two.
That has proved difficult for Ayotte, who's put herself in the awkward position of not explicitly endorsing Trump while saying she will support the Republican nominee in November. Over the weekend, in a rebuke to Trump, Ayotte defended the Kahn family, which prompted the Republican nominee to lash out at her. Trump told the Washington Post that Ayotte is weak and has given him zero support. He also said he's doing great in New Hampshire. This latest poll suggests otherwise, and that at least for now, New Hampshire poses a challenge for both Trump and Ayotte. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Well, as Trump tries to turn around some of those poll numbers, one of the issues he's turning to is Iran and the Obama administration's $400 million payment to that country in January. It happened just as four Americans were released from detention in Iran. At a rally yesterday in Daytona Beach, Florida, Trump suggested the payment was ransom.
It looks like we paid $400 million for the hostages, right? Such a bad precedent. Such an unbelievably bad precedent set by Obama.
The Obama administration says it was not ransom, and White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said yesterday that the payment was one of a number of issues that the administration was working out with Iran at the time.
There was a conscious strategic decision that was made on the part of the Obama administration as we were implementing the deal to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, to resolve other longstanding concerns that we had with Iran.
Business journalist Ali Velshi joins us from New York with more on this. Ali, what do we know about this payment and what it was all about?
Well, this payment, strangely, was the culmination of many, many years, actually decades of debate around money that the pro-American Shah of Iran had paid the United States. The Iranian government paid the United States in 1979, right before the Islamic Revolution. The United States held that money. Iran has been claiming it for more than four decades, and these negotiations have been going on for a long time. Iran wanted the money they had paid plus interest. And America didn't want to do that because it didn't have a nuclear deal with Iran. It didn't have good relations with Iran. And it was subsequently released after the Iran deal was made.
But the timing is a little suspicious to all happen at the same time that four Americans were released.
Well, it's either suspicious because it looks like a payout or a bribe for the release of those Americans, or you can go with what President Obama said. And he said that when the hard work was done of getting a deal to limit Iran's capability to produce nuclear weapons, with that hard work done, it was then okay to release this money and incidentally or coincidentally get the hostages back.
Hillary Clinton echoed the administration's line here in an interview on KUSA-TV in Denver. She called the transfer old news and said what we've been hearing from the Obama administration, which is that it was not ransom. Here she is.
So far as I know, it had nothing to do with any kind of hostage swap or any other tit for tat.
Now, Donald Trump is also saying that Hillary Clinton started the negotiations that led to the transfer. What's true there?
She didn't. The negotiations about this money have been going on for many, many years. In fact, in 1981, the U.S. and Iran agreed to set up a commission at The Hague that would rule on both countries' claims. Both countries have claims on each other. In the United States, the former hostages have claims against Iran. But it is specifically a claim for things that happened in 1979, and the discussion's been going on since 1981. What Hillary Clinton did do was initiate secret talks with Iran over the nuclear program. And of course, when she left her position as Secretary of State, John Kerry took over those negotiations. They then became public. And for 18 months, they continued until last summer when it culminated in the Iran deal. So Hillary Clinton is responsible for having started the deal for the nuclear program. And one has to imagine, Jeremy, that when you're doing that, you're taking all sorts of things into consideration, including the fact that there are Americans being held hostage for in Iran. So, you know, a person would be not crazy to conclude that you are paying Iran money they want, and in exchange they're releasing hostages whom you want released. It becomes a technicality as to whether that was a ransom payment or whether it happened to be two outstanding transactions that took place simultaneously to each other.
And of course, there are also concerns about what Iran will or is using that $400 million for, because they have funded groups including Hezbollah and Hamas in the past and supported President Assad in Syria. So we'll continue to follow this story. Ali Velshi, business journalist, thank you so much as always.
My pleasure.
Even though the opening ceremonies are tomorrow, the competition at the Summer Olympics is already underway in Rio. Yesterday, the U.S. women's soccer team defeated New Zealand 2-0. 4 years ago in London, for the first time ever, American women brought home more medals than the men, and they're heavily favored to do that again in Brazil. The success of women's sports was boosted when Congress passed Title IX in 1971. The law barred sex discrimination in educational programs receiving federal money. The law did not single out sports, but it definitely expanded opportunities for women athletes, especially in college. Greg Myrie is an editor for NPR's Olympics coverage, and he joins us now from Washington. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Eric.
So give us a sense of how American women did at the 1972 Olympics before Title IX was passed.
Right. So this was the Munich Games, and the American women won 23 medals compared to 71 for the men. And in addition to that, just that discrepancy tells you something, but you had all the Soviet Union and East Germany had these big state-sponsored programs, and their women tended to be dominant. Not a single American woman won a medal in gymnastics. No gold medals in track and field. Americans did okay in swimming, but were not real powerhouses. So they were competitive, but not a great team by any measure.
So let's unpack a little more about what exactly Title IX did to help.
So it was a broad educational law saying that you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex on any education program that gets federal money. And this had a lot to do with the fact that not many women were going to graduate school or not many women were getting teaching positions. You know, it covered a lot of ground. And one thing that was sort of thrown in almost as an afterthought was this also addressed sports, where there weren't a lot of women's sports teams at universities. But it has now become synonymous as the measure that has dramatically transformed the participation, not only participation, but the excellence in women's sports in college and high school, and just been brought about this huge change that we've seen over 40 years.
A huge change indeed. You write today on NPR.org that many team sports, especially those played at colleges, American women today have become nearly invincible. Give us some examples of how this might play out in this Olympic Games in Rio.
Well, exactly like it's been playing out. The women's basketball team has won 41 straight games at the Olympics. This will be their sixth gold if they win this time.
Wow.
The soccer team is going for its fourth consecutive gold. The rowing team hasn't lost a major international race at the Olympics or World Championships in a decade. The water polo team is the defending champ. So all these sports that just produce, that are played widely at the college level, just produce a tremendous number of first-rate athletes, and then we see this turns into a national team, which is just cleaning up when they compete against the rest of the world.
Yeah, total domination. Greg, there are lots of countries that compete in the Olympics that allow fewer rights and freedoms to women. I'm wondering if there's a correlation between women's rights in these countries and those women's successes at global athletics.
Yeah, you see, Eric, I think a pretty interesting trend line here. And, you know, Europe and the United States have long always been prominent in the Olympics. But what we've seen in more recent years, or even the past few decades, is some developing countries which will do well, like Kenya with their distance runners in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And then what you see is about a generation later, their women start to do well also. So the Kenyan women distance runners are now quite exceptional. I'll give you one other very good example. In Jamaica, we've seen the same sort of thing where they've had great male sprinters. And in fact, I think probably most everybody knows Usain Bolt, who's going to go for an unprecedented third gold in the 100 meters. But what a lot fewer people know is that there's a Jamaican woman Shelley Ann Fraser Price, who will also be going for her third gold in the 100 meters. And the women Jamaican sprinters are now on par with the men, which is to say outstanding, but they still don't get the attention that the men do.
Greg, briefly, is women's participation in sports still growing?
Absolutely. It's literally about tenfold at the high school level. You have more than 3 million girls playing high school sports now, 10 times what you had 40 years ago was Title IX was just getting off the ground. So we're seeing that both at the high school and the college level, and even just stuff that's outside the schools.
Title IX. Greg Myrie is digital editor for NPR's Olympic coverage, including the blog The Torch. Read it at NPR.org. Greg, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Eric.
Now, this week, we've been talking to former Olympians about how their medals changed them and how they adjusted to life back home after the Olympic Games. Today, retired swimmer Jenny Thompson. She's the most decorated female swimmer in Olympic history, not to mention one of the most decorated Olympic athletes of all time. In all, she's won 12 Olympic medals, 8 of them gold. Jenny Thompson joins us now from Portland, Maine, where she's now a practicing physician and mother of two, including a 4-month-old infant. Jenny, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here.
Jenny, you participated in 4 Olympic Games, the first one back in Barcelona in 1992, then Atlanta in 96, Sydney in 2000, and finally Athens in 2004. You're only 19 at the first Games, a freshman That's right. in college. What was that like for you?
Oh, it was a whirlwind of emotion. You know, I was just finishing up my freshman year at Stanford and just had all of the greenness of being a 19-year-old and first time at the Olympics. It was a very, very exciting time.
You came away with 3 medals then, 2 golds in the relays and a silver in the 100-meter freestyle, an event you held the world record in. But there was a little bit of controversy about the gold medal winner. What happened there?
Well, the speculation that there was doping involved. She was from China, and they had really surged onto the international scene with 1 year leading into the Olympics, and there was a lot of controversy and a lot of speculation about that. So it was difficult to win silver to someone who you suspect is doping. But, you know, the fact of the matter is if I had tied my best time, I would have won the gold. So I said it was a roller coaster of emotion, and that was part of it.
Yeah, it must have been frustrating because you lost to someone who was, you suspect, cheating.
Yeah, there's no proof, but looking back, it's highly likely.
That gets us to the whole issue of how the International Olympic Committee can crack down on doping. Do you think they're doing enough now, today, to crack down?
I mean, I don't envy their position. They say the cheaters are always one step ahead of the testers. So it is difficult. I'm not really in touch with the exact methods they're using these days or the frequency with which people are tested. But it seems like there always could be more. And it's usually a matter of money and politics.
Still, you came home from the Games, home to New Hampshire, to a hero's welcome. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm from Dover, New Hampshire. They've always been very supportive of my swimming, and there was a big welcome parade and meeting the mayor and get a key to the city. And ultimately, they named a pool in town after me, so it was a great honor, and I've always loved my hometown, and they love me too.
And so did you leave Barcelona in 92 as a college freshman determined to qualify for the next Olympics?
I did. I really loved the sport. I still had 3 years of eligibility in college for the NCAAs. This really was no reason for me to do anything but keep trying to be better each day.
After winning gold in all 3 relays in Atlanta in 96 and 3 golds and a bronze in Sydney in 2000, did you think about retiring?
I thought about it after Sydney. I had been accepted to medical school at Columbia in New York. But some things happened along the way that kind of shifted my gears. When I first started medical school, 9/11 occurred in New York. And also around the same time, my mother was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And so that summer, after my first year of medical school, I went back to New Hampshire, spent time with my mom, and really started going to the pool, really like a therapy for me. It was meditative and fun and just a way to get away from it all. And I just started doing very well. And one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I'd won the nationals and qualified for the world championships. So it just was like a kind of a snowball effect and kept me going until 2004.
Did your mom's cancer fight inspire you at all to fight back and go to the 2004 Olympics?
It definitely did in more ways than one. I mean, how much joy she got out of my swimming really, you know, that motivated me. She loved to watch me swim. And one of the most important moments in my swimming career was winning a gold medal at the 2003 World Championships, and that she was pretty advanced cancer at that point, and she was able to make it to Barcelona and watch. And I just remember looking up in the stands and seeing the joy on her face and realizing, you know, this is what it's all about.
Then you decided to leave it behind. You traded endorsements and, you know, celebrity, so to speak, for medical school. I mean, was that a tough decision and a letdown or an easy one?
It wasn't a tough decision. I was very excited about moving on to a new challenge in my life, a new chapter. Mm-hmm. But it was difficult going from being number one in the world and having some celebrity to then being kind of chained to the medical school library desk.
Like pulling all-nighters in the library. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. It's sedentary lifestyle. The first year in medical school is all about papers and tests and things like that.
The Olympics are opening tomorrow. This is the first time since 92 that you're not there. Will you miss it?
I will. I love my son, Ryder, but I'm sad not to be there. And it was a decision we made, you know, with all that's going on in Rio. It didn't seem like a responsible thing to do to bring a four-month-old. But I know I'll be heading to Tokyo in the next Olympics to watch. That's a commitment that I've kind of made to myself to go and watch the Olympics until I can't.
Jenny Thompson is the most decorated female swimmer in Olympic history. She won 12 medals over four Olympic Games. She's now a practicing physician in Portland, Maine. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
Coal-burning power plants are facing pressure from new federal regulations to reduce their carbon emissions. And one way to do that could involve algae. From Here and Now contributor KJZZ, Andrew Bernier reports.
Inside Arizona State University's Center for Algae Technology and Innovation, or ASCATI, green liquid inside large test tubes bubble and stir. Inside each one, a different strain of algae species reacts to carbon dioxide. Professor Thomas Dempster is watching to see which of these is growing the most.
Part of our selection process is to isolate each of the strains, bring it back into the laboratory, and expose it to nutrients and carbon dioxide to do growth trials. Will immediately eliminate a number that don't grow well at all.
The algae was taken from water sources at Salt River Project's Coronado Generating Station, a coal-fired power plant in eastern Arizona. The plant produces more than 6 million tons of CO2 annually and needs to reduce that to meet new EPA rules. Left to figure out how to do this, plant engineer Sam Villalobos noticed algae in the coal plant's retention and evaporation ponds and thought the tiny plant may help absorb its CO2 emissions, so he went to ASCATI for help.
We're always trying to look at ways to reduce and control the emissions. So when we were looking at this, this was one of the technologies that looked like it had potential that we decided to explore.
Professor Thomas Dempster's lab has exposed the algae up to 12% CO2 concentration, about the same as the flue gas released from the Salt River Project plant. And of the near 100 species collected and brought to ASCATI, Dempster says 22 have shown promise. He points to one test tube with a dark shade of green.
This is currently our most promising strain. It grows very fast, thus captures a lot of carbon. But it also produces a somewhat unusual omega-3 fatty acid, similar to fish oils, but has a lot of potential health and dietary supplement value.
So much value that it's changing the algae industry, says Mark Edwards, a retired algae industry researcher. He says algae was originally grown to produce biofuel, but now other products from algae have become much more desirable.
Economics drives the industry, and that's why the industry has evolved from biofuels, which now are $60 a barrel, and a barrel of omega-3 fatty acids is worth $15,000.
Edwards believes the research may advance algae production. He says for every ton of algae, nearly 2 tons of carbon dioxide are absorbed.
If you take the gas and put it through an algae pond, the algae is going to grab a lot of that carbon and through photosynthesis make hydrocarbons out of it, which you can make then into food, fuel, biofertilizers, and even animal feed.
Edwards notes coal plants run nonstop, whereas photosynthesis happens only during the day. But he says productive algae growth needs at least 70 degrees Fahrenheit and lots of light, making Southwest power plants an ideal location for this research. Outside Ascati, large raceway ponds circulate algae in bright sunlight. Villalobos says in the future, the smokestacks would be redirected into massive algae ponds. But as a pilot project, the infrastructure would look a little different.
Hooking up a small 4-inch pipe on the stack to see if we can even get that flue gas to go over to the algae bed, maybe a couple hundred feet of pipe. The pressure behind it should be enough to move it through, and then a small reactor bed with the algae on site to see if that algae can actually survive.
Villalobos says there will be cost, but the cold fire generating station calls the research an investment. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Bernier.
Let's take a break now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Anthony Valadez is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. He is back with us once again. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. And let's get to some of the music you brought us. This is the London-based singer-composer Jacob Collier covering the Stevie Wonder song, You and I.
Will it stay? The love you feel for me, will it stay? You will be by my side to see me through until my life is through. Well, in my mind, we could conquer the world.
It's crooning right out of the 1950s. I feel like I'm watching Dobie Gillis or something like that.
Man, but that was all him. All those harmonies were him. I'm not sure if you know his story. He kind of had his little claim to fame via YouTube and recorded some excellent Stevie Wonder covers with multiple videos of him in one shot. And this kid plays many different instruments, and he'll record a track, and it's all him. And by the way, after this session, I encourage your listeners to go to YouTube and watch him perform live. This kid is crazy. He's playing the keys, and he's sampling. Then he's playing the drums, percussions. He's singing different harmonies. He's incredible.
And when you say kid, is he young?
He's 21 years old. As you mentioned, he's out of London. And the way he incorporates technology into his live performances is mind-blowing. And not just that, but I love that he's paying homage to jazz, and there's a lot of jazz fusion in there. For instance, he could have just covered that song and covered what was there, but instead you see him hitting these notes and exploring these different harmonies, which I think is great and challenging for most artists today.
And it's a great product in the end. Let's get to the next one. This is the Buffalo-based singer-producer John Bapp. Here is Don't Run Into the Dark So Quick.
Wait up, here I come, don't run into the dark so quick. I know you're going on your own, but we're in this together. So when it comes, if you see no light up there to color your skies, and you start to cry, I bet I'll be there for you through and through, right by your side.
Anthony, I feel like you must be in a subdued, reflective mood this summer, because usually your stuff is so much dancier.
Come on, man. It's 2016. Yeah. We lost Prince. We lost
That's
Fife.
True.
We have wars going on. You know, music has been my escape this year, I must say. And John Bapp, just you know, he's a DIY artist. It sounds so raw. And what's interesting as well is he just put out a record earlier this year and just days ago recently released another album. And it's so raw, it's acoustic, and then the next one is electronic, and these beats that quite are not on time, and sometimes his guitar sounds out of key, but it works and it's magic. So I think during these times, I enjoy a little magic and rawness and DIY.
Well, and he has said, we talked about Stevie Wonder earlier, he has said that he's been influenced by Stevie Wonder as well. What else should we know about John Bapp?
Well, John Bapp, oh my God, well, first off, he's a 6 foot... this guy is like hard to miss. I met him in Dallas. I was out there for the Warped Tour, and there was something special about this guy, and he was more into his food than talking about his music, and I think food was the factor that made me become intrigued. And once I heard the music, it was just raw and very unpolished, and especially this song, there's something honest and pure about it that I love.
All right, well, let's get to the next one. This is the Boston musician, Serral. This is called Sway.
Make me swoon, make me sway with your arms, with your rhythm. Let us dance in the rain, in the war, in the prison. I see it in your eyes. You're thrilled, adrenalized. But little do you know what's on my mind.
Okay, forget about subdued and reflective. I think Anthony Valadez has fallen in love.
You know what? I'm getting older, man. That's what it is. I'm now approaching, you know, the late 30s, and I'm more introspective. And I think like this song is very retrospective. Her name is Serral, and originally Cheryl Chow, and she's from Boston. Somebody that I came across via SoundCloud. You know, every Monday night when I prepare for my show, I love to go through SoundCloud and kind of see what's happening under the radar. And this is one of those artists that, again, you don't know what you're going to get. She has these collage pieces that incorporate strings and drums and vocal samples that sound like you're on acid. Like, what am I listening to? And then she has a song like Sway that you can tell that she's falling in love and she's on a musical journey herself. And what's funny was I reached out to her and said, hey, I love your music. I want to support you on KCRW. And she's one of those artists that, like, oh, that's great, thanks. You know, if somebody had approached me 10 years ago and said, I want to play your music on KCRW, I'd be like, I made it. But I love these artists that are like, oh, thanks, you know, I just make music. And there's something magical about that. And now she just put out this brand new record. And I'm excited for her to graduate from the SoundCloud generation into the iTunes digital platform. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that is really a sign of the times, that those are the generations from the SoundCloud to the iTunes digital platform. Next, she'll be on Amazon Prime. Okay, let's get to the last one that you brought us here.
Let's turn it up a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. This is Sonny Colone with Sweet Pearl.
The ocean, even better than a diamond. We had too many of you. Always feel you need something, but you can never understand. You couldn't recognize a diamond if you held it in your hand. Cheap thrills.
Now there's the Anthony Valadez I know.
There we go. Wake up. Wake up, America.
Wake up.
Sonny Colone. I mean, I had to throw something up there that was upbeat. But this kid has a story. He lived in L.A., moved to New York, came back to L.A., lived in his car for a period of time, and recorded what would eventually become this EP, which is known as Theory Disco. And, you know, he's pushing the boundaries of R&B music, similar to Frank Ocean. I'm pretty sure he hates that comparison, but he's doing something different. And I love that he channels disco. You know, he messes with that four on the floor. And there are moments on this EP where it's something you would listen to at 2 a.m. when you're driving home after a club, or maybe you just can't sleep. I don't know. But this song, I love this one. It's just so much energy and it's sexy.
And by the way, you called him a kid as well. He's 24, right?
That's correct. He's now based in L.A. And another interesting thing, you know, we were talking about SoundCloud and iTunes. This EP, you have to Google and look for it. It's not even out. And I don't understand how these artists make this brilliant music and you can't buy it. It's this whole new thing where, you know, they're being mysterious and you have to search for it. You have to be in the know. But that's why we have Here and Now, because I'm letting you know that you need to Google this, buy it, and turn it up in the car.
Well, and I will say the other thing that's difficult when they actually haven't released their music yet is we can't put it on our Spotify playlist because it doesn't exist. But we will get it there if we can find it. Anthony Valadez of KCRW, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. Have a great day.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Search for NPR Here and Now, at least all the ones that are out so far. And you can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
You may have never heard of the musician Dezo Daw, but the German-born rapper, whose real name is Dennis Cuspert, was a veteran of the European hip-hop scene. That was before 2010, when he quit the business and eventually made his way to Syria, where he joined the Islamic State as a recruiter, fighter, and propagandist. In October, U.S. officials declared Cuspert dead after a coalition airstrike near Raqqa, ISIS's self-declared capital. But after a profile of the ex-rapper came out in the magazine The Fader, the Pentagon backtracked. Turns out the pop star of jihad survived. Amos Barshad wrote the article in The Fader, and he joins us now. Amos, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about Dennis Cuspert when he was still rapping and going by the moniker Dezo Dog. Who was he then?
Well, he was a member of the Berlin scene, and it was a kind of a fair-sized scene. He wasn't necessarily the most distinguished or the most famous. He was kind of just, a core part of it. I think he kind of knew everyone. Everyone knew him. He put out some stuff that was kind of reminiscent of a lot of 90s American hip-hop. To my eyes, it looked, like he was probably a big fan of Wu-Tang and Mobb Deep. And specifically Tupac as well. He kind of named one of his albums a German translation of a Tupac album called All Eyes on Me. So he wasn't, you didn't look at him and say that he was necessarily doing something different or interesting. You could really tell that he was trying to carry forth a certain tradition that American hip-hop fans would be very familiar with. But, of course, rapping in German.
Yeah, and he was one of the few Berlin rappers to own the sort of hard knock gangster persona. He was in and out of jail. He was in a street gang in Kreuzberg, a once rough section of Berlin. Here's the song Willkommen in meiner Welt, which is Welcome to My World. Willkommen in meiner Welt voll Hass und Blut. Ich schreibe Zeit für meine Kinder und das mit Blut. In einer Welt, wo man nicht mehr weiß, was der nächste Tag bringt. Kinder seelen weinen leise, wenn der schwarze Engel singt. Willkommen in meiner Welt. The video for this song combines gangsta imagery you'd see in an American rap video, in the 90s, but there's also scenes of him praying. What do we know about when he converted to Islam, Amos?
It's unclear. I mean, he's had interviews throughout his music career, and at certain times he claimed that he was a Muslim from birth. At other times, it seemed more like in the mid-2000s, 2007, 2008. By the time this song comes out for sure, he becomes more and more of a regular goer to mosques and a regular, praying and attending to all the Muslim traditions.
What did you find out about how and when he joined up with the Islamist terrorists of ISIS?
It's kind of a convoluted story, as you can imagine. You don't just wake up one day and head to Syria.
I mean, jump on a plane to ISIS land. Yeah.
So he started off having some interactions with a imam in Berlin called Pierre Vogel, who was of the Salafist tradition. And this stuff was posted online. And then soon thereafter starts an organization called Milatu Ibrahim, which was, a small group kind of dedicated to online propaganda. And then eventually in 2013 is when he finally leaves Germany. He's in Egypt for a bit. He joins up with a different group kind of allied with ISIS. And eventually he declares his oath to ISIS in like 2014.
Then for ISIS, he becomes a recruiter using online propaganda. And he makes music singing these nasheeds or Islamic devotional songs. Let's take a listen. An euch Feinde Allahs, wo bleiben eure Truppen? Wir können euch kaum erwarten. Vernichte sie Allah, lass uns über sie siegen. Nimm von uns in Ehren, nimm von uns in Blut. Fisa bidin. Nasheeds are traditionally positive songs about Islam, but these are very different. In this song, he says, enemies of Allah, we want your blood. It tastes so wonderful. In another video, he appears to be holding up a severed head of a man he claims he executed. Kind of twisted nasheeds, yeah?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Obviously, most Muslims would totally disagree with even the use of nasheeds by the Islamic State. That they're totally perverting the idea of what they are traditionally, and even using the term is completely incorrect. But that is, the ISIS propaganda arm. They kind of co-opt that term, you know, for their own ends. And of course, it has nothing to do with the what traditionally a Nasheed is.
The Pentagon claimed he was killed in an airstrike. Tell us how you found out he was, in fact, alive and well and still working for ISIS.
There had been some rumors online from various jihadist watchers, and there was a Berlin intelligence authority that had claimed that they couldn't confirm his death. So the speculation was running. And then I reached back out to the Pentagon, kind of half assuming that they would just confirm their previous reports. And then they let me know that they'd actually updated their intelligence, that he was, as far as they could tell, not killed in October 2015, that he had survived that airstrike and was presumably still alive in Syria.
Do we think he's back in Raqqa making videos again, or don't we know?
We'll just have to wait and see. So far, he hasn't reemerged, which could maybe he's injured, maybe other situations have arisen, but it's hard to say right now.
Amos Barshad of The Fader speaking to us about Dennis Cuspert, also called Dezo Dog, the German rapper turned ISIS terrorist and jihadist propagandist. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.